me when I saw, personally, I saw one of the most wide-ranging people who were running. Rudy's work as a mathematician, a computer scientist, a science fiction writer, a popular science writer. He really was able to bring many different perspectives on the ideas being raised in artificial life and many other ideas in the worlds of mathematics and science and engineering. So it's great to have Rudy here to talk about some of his more recent work. Rudy is, I think you said this is his 26th book that he's published, again, a combination of science fiction and popular science. His most recent book is a popular science book, The Light Box, The Seashell, and the Soul, What Gnarly Computation Taught Me About the Ultimate Reality, the Meaning of Life, and How to Be Happy. Rudy.
Thanks, Mitch. Yes, yeah, it's very nice to be here, the sort of cathedral of computeristic techness. I'm not quite... I don't want to use the word geek, okay? But it's yeah, it's nice to be here. It's nice to see Mitch again. That was a very sort of a magical conference, the first Artificial Life Conference, all these different people coming together. And it's something that, one of the things I got really interested in there was cellular automata, and a lot of the examples I'm going to talk about today have to do with cellular automata. And just a quick picture of a cellular automaton. Here's some of them. These are some of my favorite ones. This is some freeware. It's called Kapow. And I wrote this with my graduate students at San Jose State University. And it's Kapow because we were funded by the Electric Power Research Institute. And these are continuous valued cellular automata where each of them, we have an array of pixels, and each pixel holds one or two real numbers. The cellular automata, you've all seen, like the Game of Life, that only has one bit per pixel or one bit per cell. And then it's always interested me to put in a real number. And what these guys have in common is they're all, the underlying rule is quite different in each of these nine cellular automata you see here. And this is actually a pattern file you can load. It's called AintPaint. Is the name of it, and that has to do with a short science fiction story I wrote called Ain't Paint about some people that make wallpaper that looks like this, live, you know, Jabotinsky reaction. Anyway, these are scrolled, but these are a good example of what I call gnarly computation. Now, I'm going to go into a PowerPoint now, go into PowerPoint mode. And this is, you can find this online. Pretty much all the stuff I'm going to mention today, you can either go to my homepage, rudyrucker.com, and then if you put a /lifebox after that, you'll get the stuff that has to do specifically with this book that I'm talking about. And also, there's a download page where you can download Kapow. And you can actually find this PowerPoint online, too. I recently found out if you want to put a PowerPoint online, it's best to convert it to PDF. Otherwise, Microsoft will try to make you. It won't work. You know, you'll have to download more components and so on. Anyway, so gnarly computation. Let me talk about that. And it's, again, has to do mostly with this book that I just published. This is sort of the... I moved to Silicon Valley in 1986 near my 40th birthday. And at first I thought I'd written popular books on infinity and on the fourth dimension. I thought, okay, I'll find out about computer science. I'll just get in here and do this quick research job. And then I sort of got eaten. My cover story ate me. So it was like 20 years before I could actually write this book about the meaning of computer science. And I sort of went native on the story. And I was a computer science professor at San Jose State for those 20 years. And I also worked at Autodesk, the graphics company in Sausalito. And one of the things that sort of got me into computer science was meeting Stephen Wolfram. I met him around 1984. And probably most of you have heard of Stephen Wolfram and his book, A New Kind of Science. And his sort of pet is this particular shell. It's called the cone shell. And I'll say a little bit about why that's the shell I'm referring to in the book's title. Okay, now let me move into it a little bit here. The book title, it's A Dialectic Triad. I like to brag that I'm the great-great-great-grandson of George Hegel, the German philosopher, on my mother's side. Yeah, it's actually, we even have some old family pictures of him. And, of course, his thing was the thesis, the antithesis and the synthesis. Though, if you think of the synthesis as being the bridge, it makes sense to put the synthesis in the middle. Okay, so the idea is here, that's the title of the book is A Dialectic Triad. The life box is a certain thesis, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a second. The antithesis is the idea of the soul, and the synthesis is the seashell, as it represents gnarly computation. Now, I'm going to need to unpack that a little bit. So what do I mean by that? Well, here's a picture of it also, just before we get going. So thesis, it's the life box is the notion that a life box, it's a word that I made up. It's always useful to use words you make up because then people can't argue with you about what they mean. I remember Claude Shannon told Norbert Wiener he should always use the word cybernetics because that was a word he'd made up, and that always gave him the high ground in any argument about it. Now, the life box, it's something I put in several of my science fiction books and stories. It's this idea which we're actually almost there. It's the blog is approaching a life box, but you have to be sort of somewhat technical to do a blog. I mean, well, you have to be willing to type and use a computer interface. But Nokia, they were making a product called the Life Blog, and that's you just basically talk to your cell phone and tell it what you're doing. You take pictures with your cell phone. It saves them. You get this database. The idea, pushing a little further, the life box, this is probably a product. In fact, you here at the Media Lab, it seems like some of you might be working on a project of this nature. A lot of times when people retire, they want to write their autobiography, and then they discover that it's very hard to write. People tend to think it's not very hard to write, because we can all write a little bit. But then the problem is that your life is a fractal. It's a fractal of fairly high dimensions, branch and branch and branch. And then if you want to write a book, you've got this kind of linear, one-dimensional narrative, and it's hard to squeeze this great hay bale of associations, this tumbleweed into a line. Now, the idea of a life box is simple example. Suppose you had your cell phone, you walked around in your spare minutes, your phone would ask you questions about yourself, and you would tell it stories. So it would be, in essence, interviewing you. It would have, you know, reasonably good, it wouldn't have to be great, but reasonably good language recognition. So it could at least be at the Eliza level of following up questions, asking you, tell me a little more about this, tell me a little more about that. And then it would accumulate, and if you like, you could also type data into your life box, and it would accumulate all this stuff. And then what the life box would do in the background would be set up a reasonably good system of links, and it would also have a little bit of recognition. So you could ask it a question, and then it would answer in your voice. So then you're dead, your grandchildren have your life box, they say, Grandpa, you know, what kind of car did you drive? And then you go off in your car, and then you can interrupt it and say, you know, whatever, did you ever have sex with girls in your car? And, you know, it might give you the answer. It might say you're not old enough to hear that story. And, okay, so this is familiar kind of idea. Now, the next step, and this is, so there we've sort of beat the Turing imitation game. We can get something that can kind of carry on this conversation with you. And partly because we're giving it this humongous database to mine out of. So it can seem a lot smarter. It's not like a true Turing test beater would kind of be creating all the words ex nihilo, but here we have something that is basically cutting and pasting things that somebody said. They actually have done this with Philip K. Dick. Federal Express, of all people, recently funded a project to make a Philip K. Dick robot. And the way it works, it has this huge database of everything he wrote, picks out relevant snippets. The next thing, of course, then you'd want to animate it. And this is the hard part, and this is the AI problem that we really aren't all that close to solving. But there's always, maybe in 10 years, as we always say, maybe in 10 years, we'll have the AI where you could animate it. It could be putting together concepts and having some new ideas. So anyway, the upshot is the thesis, the Lifebox thesis, is the idea is that ultimately a person could be viewed as this database of memories and some kind of animating software. And then you say, okay, now I've created a person, and that's a computer program. Now, the antithesis is the soul, okay? The soul is the idea that I'm not just some smart cell phone. I'm something much more than that. I'm something much more complex, okay? That's most people's, the average person will always say, well, I'm not, you know, I'm not a computer program for various reasons, which I'll go into in a minute. Now, the synthesis is the idea, well, maybe, at least on the street, people don't really have an idea of how complicated a computer program could be. So maybe you could be a computer program, but you're a gnarly computation. You're so complex that you don't realize that you are one. Okay. Now, a little more about these three components of the triad here. The thesis is, there's a word, I made up this phrase, universal automatism. It just seemed like a nice word for it. And it's the idea is that everything in the world is a computation. Now, if you want to say that everything is a computation, your definition of computation is going to have to be fairly generous, okay? Because otherwise, the argument's not going to go through. So I'm going to say computation is any process that obeys finitely describable rules. And the finitely describable thing, the thing is, tautologically, any process obeys the rule of act like yourself, but it might be the description of most processes would be endlessly complex. So we have the idea, that's kind of the essence of a computation, is we have this sort of short description of what it's doing. And here, rather than short, I'm saying finite, which is to be fairly generous. Now, obeys, actually, what's being snuck in there is that the computation is deterministic. Because if something is actually obeying this finite set of rules, you can give it a certain set of inputs, and you can always expect to see the same outputs come out of it. So I don't say deterministic here, but that's actually entailed by saying obeying the rules. So universal automatism is saying the world consists of many computations at high and low levels. Now, sometimes, like MIT's own Edward Fredkin was one of the first people to say the world is a computation, and he had the idea the world was some kind of cellular automaton. And even now, Stephen Wolfram wants to think of the world as sort of a string rewriting system. He says that things like particles, they're really more like, it's like there's this sea of computation that lies under quantum mechanics, and particles are these sort of emergent things there. And it's possible, now that might be right, things like spin networks or little quantum loops. Maybe there's these real little things behaving like computation. But for our purposes, I'd rather think in terms of computations at all sorts of scales. One thing nice about computation, like atoms, they're just sort of at one size. We have this small, kind of very small atoms. But we can think of large-scale computations and small-scale computations. And that's kind of our experience with computation, is that there's always these different levels that we're working at. There's your graphic user interface, and then there's the computer code under that. Then there's the, assembled machine code under that. There's the microcode. There's the architecture of the chip. There's all these different levels that we're used to working with. And this is kind of a useful way to think about the world. Now, this is where the rubber really meets the road here when we argue about universal automatism. The thing that people always want to argue about is the mind. So is the mind made of computations? And over the years, pretty much any one thing that people would say is characteristic of the mind, the AI people have sort of been able to pick that off. Like philosophers will sometimes say, a program can't plan. But then we can write out, we can say, well, look, I mean, we've written like robotic software. A robot wants to get from here to there. It'll figure out the sequence of moves that it's going to do to get there. You might say, well, we have emotions. Well, also you can give a robot, you can say achieving such and such has a weight of plus 10, doing such and such has a weight of minus 5. Try to optimize your score. And so, in effect, it has things like emotions. It's seeking certain behaviors out and avoiding things. So one of the big problems with the human mind is the idea of the self. We have this intuitive feeling that the I am, this underlying notion that we exist. But that, too, we can do something about. Before going on to that, here's another little picture. It's sort of about how the book is organized. So this is using the idea of universal automatism. The book that I'm sort of promoting today has 6 chapters, and it's organized. It's this sort of medieval way of doing knowledge. They called it the Ordo Sciendi, the way of knowing. So we would start with the most primitive level, computer science, then view physics as computations, biology as computations, psychology as computations. Sociology, that is mass behaviors of the hive mind, as computations, and then philosophical things in a computational sense. In the old days, I would have put math at the bottom, but now I've been a computer scientist so long that I put computer science at the bottom, and I'll put math up inside the philosophy. I've kicked it upstairs. Now, let's get back to this thing, the antithesis. That's the issue that life doesn't feel like a computation. And I have a lot of sympathy for this. I only really half believe universal automatism. It's sort of, it's like, it's always fun to try to believe something for a while. I mean, when I was a graduate student, I did my work in set theory, and I used to think everything is an infinite set. And then I got interested in relativity theory, and I thought everything is curved space. And these days, I'm in the habit of thinking everything is a computation. That doesn't mean I'm like an overly zealot of this belief, but it seemed to me at least entertaining to say, what if I... In German, they have the expression, ein Philosophie als ob, a philosophy as if. So why don't I suppose that this is true, or at least try to believe it, and see how far I can push it, see where it gets me. But again, the thing is, there's this immediate existential feeling that really 90% of the time I'm not feeling like a computer, at least in the sense that I know computation. Well, one thing to remember is computation isn't just, something that a calculator does. Particularly for me, looking at cellular automata, doing graphical things, like again, looking at these kinds of ongoing things, gives me this sense. I mean, these are ongoing processes, these are computations, but they're parallel, they're ongoing, and they're really not like your idea of just, some robot reciting a list of numbers. So computation, again, as we've gotten a little more sophisticated, our idea of what computations are like has grown a lot. This one's one of my favorite ones. This is a cubic wave equation. Now, if we can just flip this, let me flip it just to the flat view. And it's a nice mixture of things going on here. We have these sort of deterministic-looking scroll patterns, and then there's this sort of waves undulating in the surface. And so this is when I look at this, I say, well, maybe my mind could be something like this. This doesn't seem impossible. That my mind could be something of this nature. Because I've got these centers in my brain. There's these sort of fixed ideas that I have, these thought loops, and they're similar to these scroll patterns. And then there's trains of thought that are more like these wave patterns that go around in there. And we can throw a few rocks in this. This is like, let's just ding it a few. Oops, clicked the wrong button. Okay, where'd I go? Good Lord, I just closed it. Okay. Instant death, ego death. Let's see if we can get it back again. Wow. I just want to open that my favorite pattern there. That's my 2D. 2D. Thank you. This is always the danger of doing a demo during your talk. Okay, there it is. Okay, so this, let's get this guy back. There. Okay, so this is like I had an idea here now. It's percolating out of my brain. And, yeah, that's pretty. Okay. Now let's go back to the slides here. So, again, Antithesis Life doesn't feel like a computation. I was just, the reason I was showing you those colored pictures there was just to remind you a computation doesn't have to be something totally like filling out a tax form. There's a sense of being conscious merging with the world. That's like if you're looking at nature, if you're involved in nature, you feel at one with things. You don't feel like a separate part. And this, again, this could just be saying, well, there's this cosmic computation that I'm part of. Dreams, sometimes we feel like dreams are things that are, but again, that could be just the random play of trains of thought in your brain. Visions of God, could God too be a computation? Why not? Okay. Could be the big computation. This idea of the soul, we say, well, look, I want there to be something that is, after I die, is, lives beyond my body. And then, of course, probably one of the bigger stumbling blocks to saying everything is a computation is quantum mechanics. Because at least the way quantum mechanics is commonly understood, it's that it entails probabilistic things happening. You send a photon at a beam splitter, 50% of the time it goes to the left, 50% of the time it goes to the right, and it's impossible to predict this. So that seems to be essentially non-deterministic, non-computational. There are ways out of that. One way out is to say that we have many universes, and so it actually does both things. So deterministically it does both things. I don't like the multi-universe model that much, personally, because I like the idea that there's some sort of reason why our universe is the way it is, rather than this is just one of a zillion coin flips that happened to put us here. There's another way to get around the determinism of quantum mechanics. It's called the transactional interpretation of quantum mechanics. And in that viewpoint, we say, okay, there was a reason why the photon went left instead of right. It's sort of a hidden variable theory. When you put in hidden variables in quantum mechanics, you have to give something up. And one thing you can give up is causality. You have to allow reverse causality, like future events can cause things in the past. If you do that, then you're okay with having the hidden variables. It's an odd kind of a universe, but it's not... you can make a fairly coherent theory out of it. And it's okay with physics being reversible. Maybe later, if somebody's curious about this, I can say a little more about this in the question period. Okay. I'm still explaining the title of my book. Okay, synthesis is gnarly computations or lifelike. So, classic example, free will. That's the kind of first thing that the average person will want to argue about. If you say you are like a computation, they'll say, but I have free will. And deterministic computation isn't able to change. It's predetermined what it's going to do. But I know I can choose to have either fried chicken or pizza for dinner tonight, and I don't know yet which one I'm going to do, and therefore I'm not a computation. Well, the thing is, here it turns out this is when it becomes useful to carry out the kind of study that Wolfram advocates of looking at kinds of computations. It turns out that suppose that you have like a gnarly AI life box that simulates you. Suppose you are some kind of computation. And again, the problem is the computation is deterministic, and we feel like we're not deterministic. And here's the way out. The thing is, gnarly computations are unpredictable. Now, I'm using unpredictable in a technical sense here. Actually, Wolfram uses the word irreducible here rather than unpredictable. And I find the word unpredictable, to me, it seems like a better word for this context. What do I mean by it? It means there's no computation that can emulate me in a logarithmically less amount of time, or maybe exponentially would be a better way to say it. In other words, I'm going to take t seconds to get from here to tonight, and there's no computation that can sit, I can set into motion that will compute in log t time what I will do tonight. Okay? So the idea is, if generally I'm going to say, that's going to be a technical word I define, so a computation is unpredictable if it does not allow for an exponential speed up. That is to say, there's no computation that emulates it and uses the logarithm of that amount of time. You can always get linear speed ups. I mean, that's what we do when we buy a new computer. Okay, my chip runs twice as fast, so now I've gotten this linear speed up. But it's the logarithmic speed ups that we kind of have in mind when we talk about really crushing a problem. That's when, like if you have something, you say, well, like, actually today I had lunch with Rodney Brooks. And I think Mitch took us over there to look at some of his cool robots and things. And he was saying, well, before calculus, people would say, well, how much time does it take water to drain from this odd-shaped tank? That's your classic calc-2 problem. And then used to be the only thing to do was like watch it and then time how long it took. And then they said, oh, but we can do this manipulation with symbols, we can do integration, and we can do a little computation, and we can crush this problem. Like, we can just do it in a few steps, the same thing that in the real world. An even simpler example of an exponential speed up. Suppose you want to add like 1987 to 2005. Now, if you don't know arithmetic, you say, well, I'm going to make 1,987 marks on a piece of paper and then 2,005 more marks, and then I'm going to count them. And the thing is, that's going to take, you know, roughly 4,000 steps. But we know we can do this in, you know, like the log of that, which would be like 4 or 5 steps, simply by doing arithmetic, adding those numbers. So the thing is, what turns out, and this is a principle that Wolfram sort of argues for, and then I make explicit in my book, it's the principle of computational unpredictability. Most gnarly computations that we see in the world are in fact unpredictable, meaning they do not allow for a logarithmic speedup. And that's actually not a surprise, a simple counting argument. You can show there's 2 to the n computations of a, you know, but then there's only n short explanations of them. So most things are not going to have a quick speed up. So, so that's going to be the way out. Now let me say a little more what I mean by gnarly. Oh, seashell, the last thing. Why is seashell in the title? Because cone shells. I really got fascinated with cone shells. I retired from teaching last year, 2 years ago, so now I'm a professor emeritus. I used to think emeritus meant something good. It just actually means that you don't work anymore. It's it's not like some elevated position that you've earned. You stop showing up, and then you're emeritus. And anyway, I went diving in Micronesia, and there's all these great, this is where they live, these cone shells. I have a cone shell that Wolfram gave me. It's just the shell. And it even has www.wolfram.com tattooed on it. But these guys are funny. They're see that little snout there? What he has this tongue that can come out of there, and he shoots a detachable tooth that's filled with this bizarre poison called a conotoxin. And like if some little fish is going by, he shoots out the harpoon, it paralyzes the fish with the conotoxin, reels him back in with his tongue, then that innocent-looking snout opens up to this enormous funnel about this big. I have a video of it on my blog. And then he swallows it down, and a couple of hours later, he spits out the fish's skeleton wrapped in mucus. So I just finished a science fiction novel called Mathematicians in Love. So naturally in there, I have some 12-foot alien cone shells. And there's this like bad guy is threatening my main character, one of the good mathematicians. and the cone shell swallows him. And then he's at his girlfriend's house, and at night, in the daytime, the cone shells bury themselves in the sand, and they just leave their snouts sticking out of the sand to breathe. And then they notice, like, buried next to this, the snout is sticking out of the sand, and there's this package, this skeleton wrapped up in mucus. So there, it's a Halloween story, okay? But actually, the cone shell is on their side. It's friendly. It's a mathematician, as a matter of fact. But it's from another galaxy. Anyway, but these patterns they make here, the point is these patterns are actually one-dimensional cellular automata that are kind of gnarly. Now, how many of you have seen one-dimensional cellular automata? Okay, about half of you, okay? Maybe I'll quick just show you a couple, just so you get the idea. This is a two-dimensional cellular automaton. Now suppose that just for a second we, let's see, where's my mouse? Let's open, open these. Okay, so this would be, these are one-dimensional cellular automata. Now, this one, for instance, this is a famous one that's called Rule 30. And, I'm sorry, this is Rule 90. This guy looks random, but actually he's not. That's the interesting thing. Now, it turns out Wolfram distinguished four classes of cellular automata. There's the one, class one are the ones that make these very boring, repetitive stripe patterns. Class two are ones that make, they're not exactly repetitive, but they're sort of nested in a fractal way. This is, probably a lot of you have heard the expression Sierpinski gasket. So this is Sierpinski gasket. This one is the Rule 30, and this one is what he calls class three, and it looks, William Gosper, the famous hacker MIT graduate who discovered the glider gun in the Game of Life, refers to these rules as seething dog barf. Okay, that's the technical term for it. And this is a class four. You can't quite see it now. Suppose I give these guys a random seed. If you give them a random seed, let's do to all of them. Some interesting things happen here. One thing is this guy actually looks like he's complicated now. But in a way, he isn't complicated. This rule is actually predictable, although it doesn't appear predictable. The reason it's predictable, if I were given the first line, because I know there's that Sierpinski gasket pattern coming out of each pixel that I turned on. So if I just seed it with one point again, there's really just a bunch of patterns like this are being overlaid in this guy. So I could actually, I could predict this, the line T in log T steps by saying, I'll give me the first row, I'll overlay those. So that's something may look gnarly, but it's not. Now this guy, this is the sort of hero, is this guy Rule 30, because, and I'm not sure how great it's coming up. It might look better actually if I stopped it for a second. Let's do a pause on that. So you can see it a little bit better. It's a little too much detail. It's kind of overwhelming the projector. So never mind with that. Let's unpause it. But what's happening in this guy is we gave it one single... Now, one other thing I should tell you. Sorry. I was going to explain this. What I'm looking at here is a space-time diagram. So the computational space here, those ones I was showing you earlier, the computational space was a grid, a two-dimensional grid of cells. Now here, we're thinking of the space just being a single row of cells. And here, the seed, we started with one marked cell in this empty row. Now the successive lines, this is really a space-time diagram. So this is time one, time two, time three, time four, time five, reading down the screen. So it's successive generations of what that little space is going to look like. And the reason it's called Rule 30, historically, if you write at the binary bits for 30, you get an 8-bit binary number. I mean, you can write it in 8 bits. And then that serves as a lookup table for some simple kind of pattern. But I won't go into the details of that. Anyway, Rule 30, this side looks regular. This side, gnarly, okay? Seething dog barf, unpredictable, like foam in a beer glass. Now, in some sense, this is not really the favorite one. The one that Wolfram got the sort of most excited about was this rule. It was his rule 110. And there's actually some sort of controversy, sort of worthy of, well, maybe Newton-Leibniz is an exaggeration, but Wolfram got in a big fight with one of his employees about this rule, because he wanted to prove that this rule is computation universal. Because you can see it's doing something a little better than rule 30. It's sending what we call gliders, patterns that go to the left and the right. We can view these as sort of carrying information. Then they hit something and something happens. There's an interaction. And so we kind of have information moving back and forth in this space. Let me give it a fresh seed to chew on. And it turns out with a very kind of this man who was Stephen's employee called, I think it was Matthew Cook. Is Matthew his first name? I can't remember right now. Anyway, carried out the proof. And then I went to a cellular automaton conference at Los Alamos. Or no, it was in Santa Fe around 1995. And then Cook was there, and then he showed us the proof that this rule is computation universal. But then Wolfram was angry that he presented that, because Wolfram wanted that to be in his book and not to get published first. So there's some bad blood there, sort of fighting over this result. But it's best to say they proved it together. I mean, each of them did part of it. But anyway, it's kind of a cool result, because there's something, in fact, I think maybe Marvin Minsky used to have the record for the smallest Turing machine, the least number of states and symbols that was universally computing. And then maybe Martin Davis had it. And there's actually, using the fact that this thing is universal computation, you can get an even smaller Turing machine, which is, you know, there's some people that are interested in things like that. Okay, and some of them are probably at MIT. Okay, probably more of them here than most places. Okay, but anyway, so this is an example of a gnarly computation in the sense that it's universally computing. Okay, now let me get back to the slides here. So, if we say that everything's a computation, it makes sense to do a taxonomy of computations and ask what kinds of computations exist. And then we can get some kind of insight into what kind of things can happen. And this is one of the fun things. Again, one of the things I liked about moving from mathematics into computer science was that I could do experiments. And that's something I really fell in love with, cellular automata. And the distinction, Wolfram talks about four complexity classes. We can actually make it just a little bit easier. We can say there's really mainly three things. There's, if you want to make it but simple, which I've talked about this often enough, I was talking to like make it really as simple as possible, there's too cold, there's too hot, and there's just right. Okay? The too cold are the things that die out and become constant, or the things that give you stripes of some kind or another. These are uninteresting. These are what we call simple. Then there's the things that don't do that. They're the complex ones. Now, in the complex zones, there's the ones that are what we might call too hot, the seething dog barf rules. They just make complex, really seething type things. And then there's the ones that are just right, what I call the gnarly computations. And these are the ones that are, they're at this interface between being, you know, orderly pattern and pseudo-random behavior. These are the things that we find beautiful in nature, generally speaking. Life generally tends to be of this nature. Okay. Now, rule 30 is the classic example of the too hot, and 110, the classic example of class 4. Now, in 2D, we've got these guys that I was showing you earlier. These are my Jabotinsky scrolls. If you click on that link, you can download the software. You can go here and get it for yourself if you want to. Okay, like you can go here and then click on this page and download it. Okay, this will bump me. Okay. Okay, now, so what does this lead to? Well, a couple of things. So I'm almost done here. So there's some limitative consequences that come out of these considerations. Then there's some good things. And then there's some sort of how to be happy moral that I'm going to draw from this. Limitative consequences. First of all, if something is uncomputable or unsolvable, as we say in computer science, it means that it's really absolutely unsolvable. If everything's a computation, you don't have anything else to fall back on. Either you can solve it as a computation or you can't solve it at all. And sometimes we imagine there are going to be things that help us, like analog computers. And I argue in my book that analog computers really aren't doing anything more than digital computers. And I think even quantum computers may be subject to the same deal. So there's some limits to what we can expect to do. Now there's three principles here. This thing Wolfram calls the principle of computational equivalence, which is, there's actually something wrong with it the way he states it. It's his most naturally occurring, I probably should say complex or non-simple processes, are, he says, of equivalent sophistication. It comes to the same thing to say that they're universal computations. So there's this thing that we learn in computer science. There's not a whole hierarchy of degrees of complexity of computation or richness. Once you get to being universal, then it can emulate any other computation. Now, the slightly surprising thing is it's very easy to be a universal computation. Generally speaking, if you can do arithmetic, you're a universal computation. Okay? It's not hard to get universality. Now, the thing that I find interesting is that many natural things, like if I say, well, I'm looking at the motion of this handkerchief as it moves, you know, slightly. It's this compound two-dimensional pendulum. And that's probably doing a universal computation. The hard part, of course, if you wanted to use it instead of an Intel chip, would be getting your codec. Okay, how do I code my problem into this thing, and then how do I decode the answer out? But that's... maybe we could find that with a genetic algorithm. But the idea of being... most things that we see are... fluttering leaf is one of my favorite examples. If I look at a leaf fluttering on a tree, universal computations. So nature's rich. Now, there's a slight problem with this. If somebody wants to ask me about that during the question period, we could do that. But for now, let me just finish off what I want to do. The other principle, what I call the PCU, I probably should have said complex or gnarly. Natural processes are unpredictable. That is, we can't predict them we can't get an exponential speed up of them. And that's from the point of view of someone wearing a t-shirt with Maxwell's equations, in a way that they don't like to hear that because they want to say, I can deduce everything from these equations. And you say, well, no, actually, if you want to look at a real wire, you want to look at a real electron in the real world, there's always going to be these nonlinear effects, and you're never going to, it's actually unpredictable in the sense you have to just emulate it in all its richness to find out what it's going to do. You can't just do it with an equation. So that's kind of something. Another thing, when I did my graduate work in set theory, one of the things I was interested in was Gödel's incompleteness theorem, which says that if you have any formal system of mathematics, at least as rich as arithmetic, there are going to be statements, and if that system is consistent, there's going to be statements that that system can neither prove or disprove, the incompleteness theorem. And I always wondered if this would apply to physical systems. And at the time, somebody mentioned they were reading my book, Infinity in the Mind. And I used to have a kind of weak argument that, well, if we could code arithmetic into the universe by numbering the stars, then we'd have this sort of model of arithmetic. And so we'd have an incompleteness result. But now, from these considerations, I've come to realize that you can do it more directly. Because if you have a physical system that is complex, then it's a universal computation. That means it has an unsolvable halting problem, Turing's result. And unsolvable halting problem actually means there are going to be infinitely many statements about the behavior of that system that are formally undecidable. So, actually, given any formal theory in any complex natural process, there are going to be infinitely many statements about that system that can't be decided. Which is kind of, and generally they're going to be of the form saying the system will never do this or that. Okay, they're going to be halting problem type statements. But they're going to be nested ones too. For every X, there will be a Y, or for every Y, there will be an X. So that's kind of interesting too. Now, these are all kind of gloomy things in a way. They're all saying can't do this, can't do that. Geez, how can I get back? Let's zoom out. Okay. Sunny prospects. Well, good things about this worldview. Nature uses complex, gnarly kinds of computations, and so can we. Again, this is something that we see happening, like in architecture. If you look at the kinds of buildings that Frank Gehry designs now, like the Seasail building, it used to be they'd say, well, we can only solve the mechanical engineering problems of stability for a building that's, you know, made of squares and stacked up in a certain way. And we're scared to build something that we can't solve. But then we say, but nature makes all these irregular forms and they don't fall down. And with a little more sophistication, we can start making more intricate kinds of shapes as well. Another thing, observing things like cellular automata, we have stable patterns emerging from systems that we can't understand. And this is the kind of a big thing facing computer science, is it's becoming impossible. It's so hard to write software because people expect so much from it. In particular, as for the last 20 years, we've been sort of trying to wade into parallel computing and sort of not knowing quite what to do. And the fact that there is some limited number of things that computations can do, there might be more of a feeling we could do something a little more empirical, letting solutions evolve. People often say genomics is going to be the biggest thing in the 21st century, but I also think material science is really also just in its infancy. There's so many materials that are remaining to be found. And cellular automata, when you search the space of cellular automata for as long as some of us have, you get this sense that there's a lot of really interesting things to find out there. And lots of basic science to do on the whole taxonomy of computations. Okay, now here's the last thing. In the process of writing this book, I thought it might be the last nonfiction book I write about science. So I wanted to sort of, what can I draw for my own life from these considerations? In other words, at this point in my life, if I'm doing science, my real goal is to be happy. Okay, I don't have to worry about getting tenure anymore since I'm retired. What good is this knowledge going to do me? And so I was kind of drawing a little lesson. I mentioned at the beginning there's this sort of ladder of six levels we can look at: computer science, physics, biology, psychology, sociology, philosophy. And so each, if we take some of these ideas of gnarly computation and universality and unpredictability, so let's start with computer science. One thing that probably I would imagine most of you here are aware of this in your own lives is the problem of spending too much time on the computer. It sort of like saps your life out. It makes everything gray. It makes, it ruins your body. It makes you unresponsive. You're living with your partner, you don't hear them because you're staring at the screen, you have no life, etc., etc. And the thing is, it's just, if you remember that nature is doing a computation too, we're sort of so fascinated with this box, it can do a computation, universal computation. If I start thinking, hey, everything outside is a universal computation, just think if you could see air, if you could see the vortices that are being, like the incredible turbulence that's following your motions. So, not that I follow this advice, remember, okay, but this is just advice that I might give to someone like myself. Turn off the machine and go outside. Second one, see the gnarl. And here again, the world, insofar as the world looks boring, I'm not happy. When the world looks interesting, I'm more happy. And I think we sort of have evolved to want to look at gnarly computation. If we look at like some 70s type building that's just, you know, completely rectilinear, square windows. It's not, it's too cold. It's not computationally rich enough. But when we look at actually naturally existing things, then they're a lot more fun to look at. In a room like this, there's not too much you can look at that's gnarly. There's not very much gnarly computation in here, except for the people. Okay, at least we're in here. So sometimes maybe, I don't know, even, yeah, there's not really not too much in here. Maybe if you can look at the stuff on the desks, well, this is printed. This is like this is not actual material. This is like a picture of a pattern. So it's always nice to be able to look outside and see some plants moving around being gnarly. Feeling your body. Your body, after all, is the most expensive, complex piece of hardware you're ever going to have. So it's good to be aware of that and kind of enjoy the complexity of it. Now, in terms of thoughts, I have this idea, well, a couple of things. I have this image of my thought processes being two elements. One, there are these repetitive kind of scroll patterns, and these are my obsessions. Then there are things that are more like gliders flying by, and these are the trains of thought. If I become aware of my thoughts as being like a computation, I'm kind of less controlled by them. I'm more free to not take them as seriously as I would have to. Another thing, if I accept that most processes in the world are going to have unsolvable problems associated with them, maybe I won't get too hung up on just doing logic. Open your heart. That's the idea that if, after all, one thing to remember when you talk to another person, they are a universal computation too. So, in other words, they're doing, although they may look like maybe not much is going on in their head, you know, even somebody that you might look down on for some reason, they're, you know, there's somebody that, something about them is sort of opposed to you. They might be somebody that oppresses you or threatens you. You might think, well, they have no mind, but they do. Everybody does. And that's a good thing to remember. And finally, be amazed. The universe is a miracle, and we'll never understand it all. It's nice to be here. Okay, so that's about it.
I just want to take a few questions, but then they can make it more informal after a little while, and then Pepper just come down and talk to
you. Okay.
Why don't we take a few questions as an audience, and then.
Okay, that sounds like a good idea.
People have any questions. Either on this talk or about other things, you know, other people have talked about that they've been reading out of books that they think you can open up that as well.
Yeah, in the back? Okay, you want to hear a little more about quantum mechanics. Okay, I think the idea that I had in mind was something like, if you go to my blog here, and we look at this, we look up paracomputation. See, this is my life box. I keep my mind online here. So, there's a little picture here that I can show you. The reason that's why I'm doing this, okay? So, let's see. No, that's the wrong one. Sorry. I meant to say para-time. So I'm thinking of para-time as being a dimension of time that is perpendicular to ordinary time. So, here's the picture, which, let's see, is there a way to zoom on a web page? I don't think so, is there? So here's the idea. I'm thinking of, here's a picture of space-time. Okay, that's this sheet. Time goes up, we've got space collapsed down to one dimension. Now, so that's space-time. Now, one of the things, if we take the transactional view of quantum mechanics, we're saying that the world is a reversible computation, Okay, so let me show you an example. Suppose I do this. Let's get a reversible computation here. So this would be an example. Of a reversible computation. And also what I can do here, I can at any moment I can say run this guy backwards, and then now I'm running it backwards in time, and I will go back to the state that it started in. So we can have a fairly simple seed here, and in other words, both the past, I can at any point flip back and forth between going forwards and backwards in time. So you can have a complex universe, and most physics is reversible. So the idea is, if you take the reversibility seriously and allow for effects that propagate forward and backwards in time, as described in John Kramer's transactional interpretation of quantum mechanics, then you're allowed to have hidden variables, and you're allowed to say, for instance, that we have a reverse causation. So, example, Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox. I have particles A and B are coupled here. Then they're moved far apart. I make a measurement on A, and then that affects the quantum state of B in some seemingly acausal way. You could say, well, if we allow reverse causation, the measurement on A actually sends a signal backwards in time to where A and B were touching each other, and that comes up forward, and that's how the effect actually hits from A to B. And so we say, okay, well then, space-time is this synchronistic macrame, this tapestry, where the future and the past, everything is perfectly balanced in sync. Then you say, well, how does a world like that arise? Well, if the universe is like a universal, like a reversible CA, it's really just a matter of getting two rows of the CA, and then you can extrapolate the whole past and the whole future. But how do you find a good one? That's sort of the question. And then that's where this picture here comes into play. The idea being, what it might be, there's some sort of seed that generates various sheets of space-time. And perhaps as para-time, a second dimension of time, is elapsing, we're getting better seeds that can be used to generate better sheets of space-time. So that's sort of the way, my angle on the quantum mechanical thing. Yeah?
You mentioned that
Okay, your question is, suppose you had a life box, would it be a static thing that people would just look at, kind of like a photo album, or could it be an ongoing computation? Well, the static thing, that's pretty much within our abilities right now to make something like that. Again, it's pretty much like a super complete blog is pretty much a person's life box. The animating it, that's the hard part. But there's the whole question of how soon can we get AI in our software. And sometimes there's, like Ray Kurzweil, sort of a popularizer of computer science, and he likes to say that it'll be very soon that we're going to... And then the argument that sometimes people use is Moore's Law. They say, because... You know, you can make this sort of back-of-the-envelope calculation that your mind is using maybe a petabyte of memory, like a quadrillion bytes, and it's doing maybe a quadrillion operations per second, okay? So petabyte, petaflop. And we look at Moore's Law, we say, well, look, maybe in 20 years we'll have a desktop machine that's petabyte, petaflop. Maybe Moore's Law is leveling out, but it doesn't seem... You know, it doesn't seem out of the question that we could get there. But then there's the catch. Just because you have a machine that has the power of your brain, like when you buy a computer, if there's no software on it, it's not going to do anything. Okay? So where are we going to get the software to put on this? You say, well, where did I get my software? Well, most of it I was born with. It was the thing about AI, the old line, the easy part is learning to play chess. The hard part is learning to see the chess pieces. and tell them apart on all different kinds of boards. And so it's the thing that we're born with. We have this, you know, immense neural net embedded in our brain that's evolved, and that's got all these things, these problems already solved in there. The idea of viewing the world as objects, the black box for speech, being able to recognize things, being able to see. Most of this is you would be able to do even if you... it's not so much things that you learn. Okay, I mean, you learn some things, but that's also part of the things, that's also part of our heritage, the things that our culture knows and that are passed into you. But a lot of it is just in this millennia of evolution of this immense parallel thing. So actually, then I was doing some calculations. Well, suppose I wanted to get something as smart as the human brain by mimicking, emulating the evolution of the human species. So then we amp it up, and then we need an Ubiflop computer. Actually, the names run out when you get to, I think, there's Xenoflop, Yada, and then after Yada, it's Zeta. The Bureau of Standards, they got up to a certain level, and then they said, let's start working backwards to the alphabet. So they have a prefix Zeta, and then the next one is Yada, and so the next one should start with X, and they haven't decided. Most people think it'll be Xena. Then you go a few more, you get to like Ubba or Wada. Wada would be next after the X. So you get a Wadaflop, Wadabyte computer. Then in about a year, you could simulate the evolution of the human race. And then maybe you would get the brain software you want that way. But it's not clear that Moore's Law is going to take us that far. You know, it's not like, I mean, it is going to level out somewhere. So anyway, so you asked, ideally, the life box would be ongoing. And again, another thing, this is a point that Rodney Brooks makes sometimes, is maybe there's something that we're just totally overlooking. Maybe it's not just evolving neural nets. Maybe there's some aspect of human intelligence that we haven't really hit on. And then maybe once we get this big idea, maybe the whole problem will sort of collapse and become much more tractable. What did you say? Right. Yeah, I mean, I talk about the idea of the life box, and I talk a little about how to evolve a mind, but I don't go into great detail about how to design one. That'll be left as an exercise for you all. Yeah?
I'll give you the leading question answer, and that's the limitation of Wolfram's computational equivalence.
Okay, yeah. The problem with Wolfram's idea of the principle of computational equivalence. Well, the problem is that we know there are gnarly computations which are not universal. And these were discovered in the 1960s by, I'm blanking the guy's names right now. It's in the book, okay. But in other words, there is a construction where you can make a computation that's, it has a degree of unsolvability higher than recursive, but it's less than universal. In fact, Jerry Sachs, one of you mentioned, is taking a course with him. He knows a great deal about the hierarchy of degrees of unsolvability. So there are these intermediate degrees. So if Wolfram says any non-simple computation is of equivalent complexity, then that seems to be false, okay? Because there's many degrees. So what I would do, I would actually water that principle down. I would say any system, any gnarly computation, most naturally occurring complex computations have an unsolvable halting problem associated with them. And it turns out that's all you really need to get the interesting things about it. If you have the unsolvable halting problem associated with it, then you get all the undecidable sentences about it and so on. Okay, so that's I would weaken his principle in that way. Maybe one more in the back? Or no, you're just stretching. Okay, yeah.
One more question.
Okay.
Universal commutation usually depends upon infinite set.
Right.
If the natural world computations are finite elements, aren't they all finite?
Right, that's a good point. You're making the point that in reality, if I have like the air in a room or something, there's only so many atoms there, there's only so many, maybe space and time is granular, there's only so many positions something can be in, so I can't really get, like to get a universal computer, ideally I need to have access to a potentially infinite amount of memory and so on. And I guess what we would say is, we kind of need to clean the definitions up. Okay, we want to say it behaves in such a way, if I were to keep adding more memory to it, it would behave in an increasingly complex way. And that's what we already sort of do that. When I say a personal computer is universal, again, it's not really universal unless I'm allowed to keep buying more and more DVDs to use as extra storage, things of that nature. Yeah.
Okay, well, I really want to thank Rudy for coming, and I think you can stay around for a little while if you want to come down and just chat a little bit more of it. Thanks for coming.
Okay, thank you. Oh, hi.
We've met before once or so.
Yeah, the name sounds very familiar.
Yeah,
oh, yeah, you're one of...
Email, so,
yeah, that's right. You read the book and you gave us... Yeah, thanks. Let me turn this...